This hour of the Jason Rand Show brought to you by You Build It. Lots of news is happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending in Pierce County?
Well, now they're giving up on the hazard pay line. Pierce County Council passed a hazard pay ordinance for large grocery stores, $4 more an hour. They pretended it was over safety, hence the title hazard pay. It's hazardous to go to work. Now, how it's more hazardous, more dangerous to go to work at a large grocery store than a small one, no one really knows. How it's more hazardous and dangerous now that vaccines are widely available for workers and for customers, no clue. But I want you to listen for a moment to Angel Gonzalez, who's the president of the UFCW 367. He spoke to King 5.
We work in an industry that not only has a high hazard situation in our stores, we have they've experienced massive profits because of the pandemic.
Massive profits because of the pandemic. Maybe the real reason why they're asking for more money is because they perceive the industry having more money, not necessarily even the individual stores getting more money, but the industry, which of course means if the industry does poorly or an individual store does poorly, does it mean that they lose money? Huh? Does it mean that they get less pay? Of course not. They would never take on that position. But if this is all about the danger, Bruce Dammeyer, Pierce County executive, who said, we're not going to do the hazard pay, he vetoed it. If it's all about the danger, why not address that issue? Joining me on the line is Pierce County Executive Bruce Dammeyer. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, Jason. Thank you for having me.
So you clearly don't buy this line that this is about the hazardous nature of the job. You kind of called their bluff. You believe, I'm assuming, by reading between the lines, this is just about the money play, correct?
Well, yes, and let's be clear. There are potentially some unsafe conditions. Then the best way to protect those employees and our community is for them to get vaccinated. It's pretty simple. That's the surest protection that we can give them, and we will make those shots available to them at any time they want. But when you talk about the challenge here, as you well know, is there's a number of them. But certainly our grocery store employees have been really significant. They have really been on the front lines since the beginning of the pandemic. But so have other key essential workers like our long-term healthcare workers and our nurses and our, for that matter, our first responders, some of our teachers. And there's no question that those that have been hit the hardest have been restaurant workers. So if you're talking about trying to differentiate which people get hazard pay and which people don't, when we all have battled through this pandemic, that doesn't make sense to me. And so I don't think that's a good policy for the people of Pierce County or for anybody. So we said no to that. The second issue is it only applied to certain stores within Pierce County. So if you really believe it's a safety hazard, why would the hazard at the Safeway on South Hill be really significantly different than the hazard to the Safeway in the city of Puyallup? So that really didn't make sense. And then as you can keenly appreciate, you know, I think this is an inappropriate place for a government to weigh in. We've got privately negotiated collective bargaining agreements, and I respect collective bargaining agreements. And we have, for those that aren't unionized, they've got kind of their work out with their employers. Government should not be weighing in into the middle of that at this point. So those are all the reasons why I think for the people of Pierce County, we decided to veto the ordinance.
How much of the union interests was behind this?
Well, I think if you listen to the people who are testifying, and I listened to all of the testimony, it was predominantly, by far, those in support were from the UFCW.
Yeah.
The local union.
And that's really what this has all been about, not just in Pierce County. Obviously, this is not new. This is not Pierce County being the first doing this. You did this on the heels of Seattle, of Burien. King County's been talking. Like, these are other communities that have been doing this, and this is being pushed by the unions, and they're all using the exact same language. At any point, do they explain why a grocery store is more dangerous than like a large grocery store, the Safeway, more so than a small mom-and-pop shop?
No, and those are all the questions. Some of the testimony, you know, I would imagine that some of them have, sadly, some of our some of the people, their customers haven't treated them well in certain instances, and I feel bad for them that they did that. But that doesn't justify this. And again, if it's about safety, if they're concerned about a shopper infecting them, the best way to protect themselves from COVID is to get vaccinated.
And the vaccines are widely available. For example, right now you can go to the Tacoma Dome, a mass vaccination site. It's available 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. every single day. You've got plenty of vaccination sites all across Pierce County. It's free. Grocery store workers themselves were able to get the shot earlier than other folks. There were grocery store unions out there that were able to secure the vaccines for folks earlier. Do they ever explain how $4 extra an hour makes it safer?
No, they didn't. And that was some of the challenge when I had the opportunity to meet with Angel and other union leaders yesterday. And one of the things I said is if you've got folks who are not vaccinated, we will vaccinate them today, right now at the Tacoma Dome. No appointment required. They can go up till 8 o'clock at night. We will take care of them. Because if it's about safety, that's what I want to address. We want to make our stores safer for the grocery store employees, for our shoppers, but we don't want to make the food cost more. That's already going to be enough of a challenge. And that was one of the things that was really difficult is some of the stores that when the bill finally passed the council and they made it only apply to certain stores, those that it applied to, some of them are in some of our more challenged neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
So wait a second, we're going to drive up the cost of groceries, not increase the safety, and do it in neighborhoods where people are already struggling with their own household budgets? That's not smart.
Yeah, it's not smart. It sounded a little bit like a scam, but that's all good. You were there to veto it. Speaking of sounding like a scam, Governor Inslee says we're putting a pause now that Seattle was on the line of being rolled back, and it's not even about King County, it was about Seattle, being rolled back into phase number two. We're putting a pause on that. We're going to hold off a little bit. Pierce County, however, having numbers that were almost identical to what it looked like, what it looks like right now for Seattle and King County. Obviously, there's some politicking going on. You made the point that's not science at all. Today, we learned that Pierce County Democrats have sent a letter to the governor. All of a sudden, they're saying, slow your roll here. We're going to call for a special legislative session if you don't figure this out. Where do things stand right now with the governor?
Well, you know, the people of Pierce County are naturally very frustrated by this, and I feel their frustration and share their frustration. You know, 3 weeks ago, when we asked for a pause, when we were facing the prospect of rolling back to phase two, we were told no. When we said, okay, well, then can you give us additional vaccines so we can get caught up with our neighboring counties? We were told no. When we asked, hey, can you speed our eligibility up. At that point, we were almost, it was the 13th of April. Can you make all of our people 16 years old and older eligible 2 days early? No. So that's really frustrating. But I want to be clear, Jason, I'm not frustrated. I didn't think Pierce County should be rolled back 3 weeks ago.
Yep.
I don't think Seattle and King County should be rolled back today or Snohomish County. We've got to be moving forward. This rollback stuff doesn't make sense. So let's move forward, and I've got really good confidence that the situation in Pierce County is under control, that we're seeing really starting to see the trends go in a very good direction. You know, we know that the vast majority of our folks who are really vulnerable to really bad outcomes are vaccinated, and that shows up in that the deaths in Pierce County are down dramatically. So we know that the vaccine is doing, you know, we're protecting our seniors, where our hospitals tell me they have plenty of capacity. We've got to get back and find a way to move forward, not roll back. So that's the frustration, and that's my focus. That's why we're trying to get more people in Pierce County vaccinated. I want everybody in Pierce County who's willing to get vaccinated. We want to get them vaccinated in the easiest, most convenient, simplest way for them. And that's what we're focusing on now. I've got a vaccine task force that we've been kind of meeting for 2 weeks. We're going to meet for another 4 weeks. We're on a real push to get those final folks who might be willing to get vaccinated, make it as easy as possible for them to get it done.
When Democrats start pushing back against Jay Inslee, that's when you know things definitely, definitely, definitely are not looking good for him and his decisions are really not making sense. Bruce Stammeyer, Pierce County Executive, thank you so much, as always, for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you, Jason.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Don't forget, we are giving away one smart speaker branded with the KTTH logo every single day. We're giving out one a day for the month of May. Text the keyword contest to 1-800-465-8770, and I'll send you a link so you can enter that contest. Do not miss your opportunity for the free smart speaker. Text contest to 1-800-465-8770. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at home?
Seattle City Councilmember Shama Sawant, a Washington 1%er, someone worth $500,000 despite a pledge to live off near the minimum wage while giving her council salary away to charity or some nonsense. She is pushing for a rent control bill, among other protections for renters. And in her spirited fashion, she is, of course, yelling about it.
6 months advance notice for any rent increase. We're also putting forward a bill to require landlords to pay for a tenant's move when the tenants are forced to move because the landlord increased the rent.
Okay. Under her rent control bill, rents could go up no more than the annual rate of inflation, which is about 2%. I'm pretty sure, however, rent control is still illegal. However, I, of course, am not a lawmaker. If that were the case, boy, would laws be so much different in Washington State. Joining me on the line to discuss is the Washington State House Minority Leader, J.T. Wilcox. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks so much, Jason. And yes, still illegal.
I mean, are you sure? Because I don't know if Shama Sawant, who definitely is not one for publicity stunts, would waste our time reintroducing a bill if it were still illegal.
Well, you know, Danny Westney recently said that we're all Seattle now. So if she says it, who knows what's going to happen to the rest of the state. But honestly, this sounds an awful lot like the last session. And what is happening, I think, is that rhetoric and ideology is getting totally out of control. You know, this is one more case, and we've seen this all session, of progressive rhetoric that ends up having deeply regressive results. And anyone that has been around business or the economy understands that if you make it that hard to provide housing, then pretty soon there's not going to be much housing available. And progressives so many times don't want to take responsibility for the impact of all of their rhetoric. And I think this is on display right here.
Do we have a housing issue in Washington State, truly, at least the way that progressives talk about it?
Well, we have a housing issue, probably not what they talk about. In fact, the House Republicans recently commissioned a survey that shows that homelessness is still the number one issue for people clear across the state, not just in Washington. And what House Republicans have done, Andrew Barkus, among many others, has said, okay, why don't we solve that by making it much more attractive and much easier to build more housing? Isn't that the root cause of homelessness? And if you have more housing, of course, it becomes more affordable as well. That's the solution to this, not a lot of rhetoric.
Well, isn't it? It's not even just about building more housing. It's the way you're able to build a house. So, for example, in Seattle, where Shama Sawant represents, developers get nickeled and dimed to death. The fees associated with building a house is insane. And as a result, all that does is get passed on to the consumer, which raises the rents. It's just insane.
Well, it absolutely is. And it goes along with what I said earlier. We have this progressive rhetoric, and what actually results is deeply regressive because it makes things much less available and much less affordable.
Yeah. So perhaps, and maybe this is me spitballing here, because I don't pretend to be able to get into this inside the crazy mind of Shama Sawant. Maybe she's counting on a special session in which this idea gets floated. Because today, it sounds like perhaps we're a little bit closer to a special session, even though one just got, your actual regular session just came to an end. So Pierce County Democrats apparently have sent a letter to Governor Jay Inslee. Haven't seen the letter, but it's out there, claiming that you better take care of this Pierce County situation. You paused your roll back and roll forward. Also, you can take care of King County. Make sure that you're not rolling back Seattle. And yet you just kind of screwed over Pierce County. What can you tell us about the prospects of a special session?
Well, I said, I think around the 20th of of April, that the one reason why I would consider a special session is if we were going to do emergency powers reform. I think that would be worth doing. But I also want to point out that these Democrats in Pierce County that are talking about this now are the ones mm-hmm. that voted unanimously against Republican efforts to bring a very moderate and reasonable reform of emergency powers to the floor. We had bills from day one of the session, and in the last week, we gave them one last chance by offering a procedural amendment that would bring that to the floor. Every single one of them voted no when they actually could make a difference.
What does it tell you? How instructive is this that they're doing this now? What, 3 weeks, 2 weeks after the session ends, given the opportunity, they wouldn't even have a debate about it. And now all of a sudden, when they get screwed, they're screaming about it. They're complaining about it. How instructive is that?
Well, I think that's often seen in politics. And I don't think that they ever imagined that their governor would put them in that position. And what I keep telling them is, look, this is about even a bigger thing than the current emergency, although it's hard to believe because this has had such huge impacts on people in our state. This is about good government in the future. And maybe you like Jay Inslee, Democrat legislators, but how do you know that the next person that calls a big emergency is going to be in your party? Or trustworthy? And so every one of us should care about the fact that we're in this situation where there is no end to the emergency and nobody can end it except for the governor.
So where do you think this goes? Do you think that the governor, for fear that we do end up getting a special session, which he would have to call, but I mean, do you think he just gives in and then moves Pierce County into phase number three and just comes up with a new set of arbitrary numbers to justify it and says, oh no, look, you've all of a sudden, you've, according to our plan, you do now qualify. Look, I'm a hero. Or do you think there is going to be a legitimate pushback from the Democrats that say, no, we're now ready to put in place some kind of bill that curtails your power?
Well, I'm 100% sure that if that reasonable bill would have passed and the governor knew that everyone would have to be on the record about whether or not the emergency was going to be extended, he would be listening more closely than he is now. But they all chose, every single Democrat in Pierce County decided to vote no on that. Yep. So now we're in this situation. I have yet to see partisan solidarity break among Democrats this session. So my guess will be that they work it out somehow behind the scenes. And, you know, the numbers are going down to some extent. And I think that in the next few weeks, that will be dialed back. And I can't, you know, really know what the motivations of the governor is.
It's such a sad state of affairs that we're at this point. But we're at this point because of all that partisanship. J.T. Wilcox, state representative, representative from Yelm, and of course the House Minority Leader. Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you, Jason.
Thank you. You're listening to The Jason Rants Show. Welcome back to The Jason Rants Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. It's 2021, and yet the topic of banning books is somehow still a hot topic, and maybe even an expectation, at least when folks on the fringes in the Democratic Party disagree with the content of that book, at least on certain topics. When it comes to transgender issues, any examination that strays from the full-on, no-questions-asked acceptance of literally anything that so-called trans rights activists say will be met with claims of hate speech. It's not just an appalling reaction, it's pretty frightening. A group of activists working over at Amazon, they tried to get the company to stop selling the book Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. It's written by Abigail Schreier. It was named a book of the year by The Economist. It explored why was there suddenly a rash of young girls identifying as transgender? And it gave that topic a journalistic approach. But activists, of course, didn't like it. They claimed that this was dangerous. And it wasn't, of course, just activists who wanted this book pulled. A move, by the way, that Amazon thankfully didn't take. We talked about it yesterday. A quick look at the way this was framed by the media that was covering this decision made it pretty clear that the journalists and the editors behind the coverage, they seem pretty disappointed as well. Now, we talked yesterday about how the Seattle Times covered it. But my new favorite coverage comes from the New York Daily News. It was titled, "Amazon Won't Stop Selling Books Slammed by Critics as Full of Misinformation with Potential to Hurt Transgender Youth." Joining me on the line to discuss is Abigail Schreier. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Are you at all at this point shocked with the framing of this story?
You know, I manage to be surprised every time. You know, it's insane. They framed it as full of misinformation. First of all, no misinformation has ever been. This book has no book has been more debated and pored over than this one. Amazon actually had a whole committee read line by line through the book, and no misinformation has been found. But these journalists, they go to find doctors who are paid to recommend medical transition for youth. These are doctors with a pecuniary interest in promoting transition and downplaying the risks. My book just points out the risks, and they claim it's a dangerous book. Well, yes, I imagine it's quite dangerous for their pocketbooks.
And I think that part is really important to talk about the conflict of interest. And I want to talk about one particular doctor. You had called him out yesterday. It's Jack Turbin. And he is trying to get this book banned, which is just on its surface alarming, just as a topic, to ban books because we don't like the content. But he's saying, this is a book, the very nature of which is damaging to my patients. But his basic argument is that your book means he might have fewer patients.
Well, it's not just that. He talks about, you know, mental health professionals know that they have to be very careful. They can't go around suggesting that a child might harm themselves if such and such were to occur, right? Because you don't want to put that suggestion out there. It's enormously irresponsible. And that a mental health professional would himself, you know, make that suggestion repeatedly is really alarming. Look, my book just points out the risks. I would think that any responsible doctor would look through their own patients and their own treatment and just say, okay, have I, you know, taken care to safeguard the risks? Instead, the reaction of young woke activist doctors seems to be shut her up.
What is the central thesis that you're proposing?
So my thesis is just that trans identification seems to have become a peer contagion and among teenage girls, which means these are girls who do not have real gender dysphoria, which is the biological discomfort in one, you know, the severe discomfort in one's biological sex. They don't seem to have the real thing. What they seem to be passing on to each other is yet another mode of self-harm that teenage girls tend to fall for. They tend to fall for these social contagions. This does not mean that every transgender person, you know, has fallen for a social contagion. I never argue that. I don't believe it. It just means that among teenage girls, we're now seeing a spike that's so out of scale from anything we've ever seen before. And whenever you see something like that in a new demographic, you have to ask, is social contagion participating?
Well, and usually folks will say, and I do think that this is a valid response, is we're not seeing this in a new way. We're just finally talking about it because more people who are transgender feel comfortable talking about it. So what's the response to that point?
My response to that point is that would be a good argument if we were seeing women in all age groups coming out as transgender, mm-hmm. but we aren't. We are only seeing young women, you know, the same teenagers that fall, teenage girls who tend to have high comorbidities, other, you know, high rates of anxiety and depression. They are the leading demographic now claiming to have gender dysphoria and claiming to be transgender. So it's the same girls who fall for anorexia, bulimia, and every other social contagion. You know, so I don't think it's reasonable to think, oh, this is just, you know, stigma lifting, because then we would see it from women of all age groups.
And the reason a lot of folks, including yourself, argue this is dangerous to simply say, a young girl who isn't actually transgender, simply identifying at this point, going with doctors who are quick to prescribe puberty-blocking drugs, is that's dangerous, and some of this stuff is irreversible.
That's That's right. One of the main, I mean, look, the treatments are quite risky. They have really a lot of irreversible repercussions that are quite severe and put fertility and sexual function at permanent risk. But one of the biggest risks is regret. And we're already seeing very high rates of regret among this population.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Abigail Schreier. She's the author of a very controversial book, according to some folks on the left, although people who've actually read it have said it's a really good deep dive, journalistic deep dive into an important topic. It's called Irreversible Damage. Let's talk a little bit about the presumption of guilt, I guess, on your point, on your part, that folks on the left will say that this is filled with misinformation, and you now have the burden to prove that it's not filled with misinformation. And you point out, it's funny because you had written about this in your Substack, which is abigailschreier.substack.com. Seattle Times, the left-wing author Catherine Ann Long, who you're unlikely to be familiar with, we are very familiar with her and how she frames things. She reached out to you because of an Amazon employee who accused you of hate speech. As you point out, one person accuses you of hate speech. How did she frame the question and the accusation?
Well, I mean, she said basically, you know, you know, your book, you know, why hasn't your book been banned? And why has Amazon, and she actually said Amazon is, you know, refusing to pull your book. And so in other words, the assumption is that a bookseller won't continue to sell books. Why is this bookseller continuing to sell books? And what do I have to say for myself? One person accused me of hate speech. This is just not journalists' approach. I mean, you notice her baseline assumption is that we don't live in a country with freedom of press and freedom of expression. Not a single expert has found a single fact that was misstated in the book. And by the way, I interviewed, you know, very many experts. I conducted almost 200 interviews for the book. There are a lot of doctors and experts interviewed in the book. So it's just simply untrue to say that it contains any misinformation. But I'm putting, you know, it's like Torquemada. I'm put on trial as if I have to prove that there's no misinformation because, you know, we no longer assume free speech in this country.
Yeah, and I've got the question that she asked in front of me. I'm writing an article about Amazon's refusal to remove your book from its digital shelves. And just the way, again, and to your point about how it's framed, about Amazon's refusal to remove your book. Why is the question then not framed about the issue calling for your removal of some people wanting the book removed? It's just they refuse, almost as if it's supposed to be pulled.
You know, my favorite part of my conversation with her was when she said to me, she had told me who she had interviewed, which experts, and she called me and said, I've interviewed experts of a variety of viewpoints, and I cut her off, and I said, a variety of viewpoints? You interviewed people with one viewpoint. Every one of those people makes money pushing medical transition on children.
Yeah.
So I'm the only one who doesn't. And that hadn't apparently occurred to her. She asked who else she might have called. Well, perhaps some of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of doctors out there who oppose this method.
So she did not, did she say she talked to anyone who you would consider to be on the side that isn't, in fact, pushing certain ideological positions on this?
No, and I recommended them. There's now a large group, Society for the Evidence-Based Gender Medicine is a worldwide group. It's based in America, a worldwide group of physicians and mental health professionals who think this is way too fast, that it doesn't involve real therapy, that agreeing with a child's self-diagnosis of gender dysphoria is not the practice of therapy or medicine, and that a lot of these treatments are quite risky. I mean, there's a whole conglomerate. There are many, many doctors out there and therapists who think this is way too fast. And of course, the UK and Sweden have now halted these treatments because they're very worried about the risks.
It is so absurd where we've come at this point in the culture. And I thought just the title of your Substack piece is a perfect question. And I want people to actually read it so we don't give the answer to this. But it's simply, has censorship become our baseline expectation? And that you have to ask that question, and people have to ponder whether or not the answer is yes, is just frankly, it's frightening. Abigail Schreier is my guest. Her website, abigailschreier.substack.com. Go there now and check out this piece. And of course, more importantly, go check out the book before, unfortunately, it ends up getting taken down by Amazon. Hopefully that doesn't happen, of course. It's called Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. It's available right now. Abigail, thank you so much for stopping by. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Welcome back to The Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, he just signed this morning a new voting bill that Democrats will pretend curtails your right to vote in Florida. It will be the new Georgia, no doubt. Jim Crow 3.0 on steroids, or Jim Eagle. It offers new requirements for drop boxes and mail-in voting, among some other things. Here he is from Fox and Friends.
We're making sure we're enforcing voter ID. Look, you have to show a picture ID to do all these other things in society, clearly voting. We're also banning ballot harvesting. We're not going to let political operatives go and get satchels of votes and dump them in some drop box. We're also prohibiting mass mailing of balloting. We've had absentee voting in Florida for a long time. You request a ballot, you get it, and then you can mail it in, but to just indiscriminately send them out is not a recipe for success. We're increasing transparency even better. In Florida, we track the votes coming in real time. Not the results, but we know who's voting, what your registration is, and we follow the turnout so that when the election's over, we know the universe of votes that have been cast, and it makes it so that someone can't dump 100,000 votes 2 or 3 days later. And then finally, we're prohibiting private money from basically running the elections, like these Zuckerbucks that they were doing in all these different parts of the country.
Joining me on the line to discuss the political implications is Josh Hammer. He's the opinion editor, aka the brilliant guy who runs my editorials over at Newsweek. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be back with you. I'm having a hard time stopping laughing at Zuckerbucks. That's a pretty good line, right?
That was a really good line. So is it time to cancel Florida? Are the Democrats going insane?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting, right? I mean, it's funny because in 2020, obviously, President Trump won Florida and ended up losing Georgia. But I guess it's kind of like historically, kind of in our minds, we still picture Florida as kind of this quintessential purple state. Georgia, you know, historically, it's the deep south. It's kind of a more southern state. So I think it's easier, I think, for a lot of Democrats, like, in their heads, justify kind of this mass boycott of Georgia. You know, Georgia had, like, a 6-week pro-life law a couple of years ago that some Hollywood studios boycotted. So there's a bit of a leftist Democratic Party history of boycotting Georgia. Boycotting Florida is, like, a whole different ordeal, right? I mean, like, it's a very, very, very demographically, ethnically diverse state. There's obviously a huge Latino population, Cuban, Venezuelan, Puerto Rican. There's a sizable Black population, of course, throughout the state. So kind of a whole different thing. I mean, obviously, it's an economic colossus, the state of Florida. It's one of the largest states, largest economies in the country. So I don't know. This kind of just happened, so we'll see. But I would predict, for all those various reasons, that there's going to be a concerted effort to not blow this out of proportion quite as much as Georgia, if I had to guess.
Is there anything legally problematic in any of these changes?
No. I mean, no. I as far as I can tell, absolutely not. I mean, all of this is well within the power of the states to do. I mean, from a kind of like 35,000 foot level, kind of like constitutional law 101, so to speak, I mean, the overwhelming majority of regulation of place, time, manners, procedures of elections happens at the state level. There are some provisions in the Constitution that gives Congress authority to kind of provide national rules and override the states, but those really are the exceptions rather than the rule. Voting, electoral integrity, these are kind of quintessential state issues under our constitutional structure.
Well, what's lost in this entire conversation, and I think intentionally by the Democrats, is that because of the pandemic, states were either forced to or pushed into a position where they changed procedures on the vote. They changed the procedures because people didn't want to stand in line. They believed that they were going to be spreading COVID as a result. And now these legislatures or governors are coming forward and they're basically doing some cleanup to ensure that moving forward, you can't just do a whole bunch of different procedures without any semblance of order. And that's what we saw in Georgia. And that's what we're seeing here in Florida.
Yeah, no, you're totally right to flag this, Jason. I mean, what's really going on here is the left, what they're trying to do, obviously 2020, the entire year, really, I mean, after COVID hit, but, you know, the election in particular, was anomalous. It was like nothing that we have happened in decades, you know, at least since like the Spanish flu, right? And arguably even further back than that. And because of that, you know, a lot of states, obviously, with certain examples being higher profile than others, like Pennsylvania, obviously, being a very prominent example, but like any number of states loosened up their voting laws, whether it was the drop boxes or mail-in ballots, absentee balloting, signatures, verifications, you know, the whole nine yards. We saw this all across the country. But what the left is now, what they are dedicated to doing is they are dedicated to the proposition that what we were sold, what the American public was sold as kind of like a one-time moving of the targets is now the new normal. And if you try to kind of just go back to just the status quo ante to what it was literally 2 years ago or a year and a half ago before COVID struck, then you're Jim Crow. Then you're a racist, sexist, bigot, homophobe, whatever. I mean, but it's classic leftist tactics, Jason. We see this over and over again. You give them an inch, they take it a mile. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing here is they're taking what really was sold to the public as just a one-time way to make sure people could still vote amidst the pandemic. And now if you make or you want to make the slightest of tweaks to what should have been a one-time change, you're a bigot. It's really kind of lamentable stuff, honestly.
Yeah, literally no matter what happens, you're a racist. Literally no matter what you do, you are called a racist, a homophobe, a transphobe, a sexist. That is the game plan coming from the left, and it works until it doesn't. The question is, how much longer will it work? And obviously it seems to be turning against the Democratic Party, and it can't stop soon enough. We've been talking with Josh Hammer. He is the Newsweek opinion editor. Josh, my friend, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Anytime, Jason.
You've been listening to The Jason Rancher. Thank you so much. Don't forget, I'll be on Fox News at night at 9:20 this evening talking about how the left is using the nonsense claims of racism whenever it is they can. Did you know that walking on a sidewalk is racist? Yes, it is. I will be talking about that later this evening on Fox News. Thank you so much for tuning in. Coming up next, Ben Shapiro.